What's going on, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to Stories from the Foul Line. I'm your host, Nick Nasby. I'm joined by the Philly Bulls, Mike and Mark. Mike, first and foremost, how's your appendix? Is it gone?
It is. It had to be removed, but I am great to go now.
Did you keep it in like a jar?
No, I didn't keep it in a jar. I'm not like Kevorkian or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, I'm feeling good now, so I'm ready to record. Just recovering a little bit, but I feel great. Let's get this going.
Good, man. Happy to have you back. We missed you last week. Also joining us, obviously, is the other co-host, Mr. Mark DeQuilla. Mark, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I'm getting ready to graduate here in like a month or so, just enjoying my last month of college or so, you know, going out, having a good time, focusing on my schoolwork, and of course our podcast, and trying to consume as much of this sports mania we have going on right now. I mean, like, the rest of the industry seems to like to call this the dead time because there's no football and March Madness just ended. For me, this is the best time of year because you got baseball, my favorite sport, going every single day. And then you got basketball, probably my second favorite sport, going down to crunch time. Crunch time in every single way. And, you know, we watched Luka hit that buzzer beater last night. It seems like every game's going down to the wire and the playoff picture is shaping up.
As someone who peaked in college, I will tell you, it is all downhill from here. Just saying.
I've been
that
warned.
Being said, though, that was a good. I mean, last night, yeah, we watched Luka hit the buzzer beater. He does this weird lean in 3-point shot. He's done that like a couple times now, and I'm pretty sure both of them that I've seen at least were been buzzer beaters that he does from there. It's kind of like, you know, when someone's playing Pong and they have their elbows, like they're like, you got to call elbows on them because they're like leaning in heavy. Like that's what Luka's been doing. He's like, as long as my feet are behind the line, then it's fine. And he's right. You know, can't fault him for it. It's a good shot. So that's been a very interesting storyline watching the Mavericks surge. Really fucking annoying for me because the Knicks have their unprotected first round pick. And I was really hoping that unprotected first round pick would be a top 10, especially in this draft coming up. So it's not going to be. And the Knicks are good too, so we're not going to get a lottery either. It looks like we're going to the playoffs. It's been a very up and down season, very interesting. Everything's up for grabs. You know, they tried to develop and assemble this super team in Brooklyn, but it seems like they can't really get all on the court at the same time. LaMarcus Aldridge retired today. I don't know if you guys saw that news. Happened just a few hours ago from the time that we're recording this. He had some heart issues going on. Called it quits after, I want to say, a 15-year career. So kudos to him.
I did want to touch on that because I was wondering, I don't know if you guys have heard anything, but excuse me, was that a Caris LeVert situation? I was wondering if that was something that was revealed during his physical because it seemed like odd timing.
It was an irregular heartbeat. He had an arrhythmia of some sort. He said he played the last game with it, and I guess it had been something that's consistent. And when it started to become consistent, he said, you know what, it's not worth it. I mean, we've seen guys die on the court from stuff like that. So I think that he made the right move, to be honest, you know, for himself, for his family, for his future. He's made a lot of money in the NBA. He's not getting any younger. He's not honestly getting any better. His step's not getting any faster. And it's just like at the end of the day, he was a defensive. He wasn't going to help anybody on defense. He was solid contributor on offense. Good. Happy trails to him. Hope everything works out moving forward. But, you know, that's something about that Brooklyn Nets team that they tried to assemble the super team. And they got the three stars and they have the supplemental star-ish in Blake Griffin. And I think they'll be okay. So, you know, we'll see what happens there. But they are not the first place in the East anymore, or they haven't been at all at any point this season. So, and last night, I thought, honestly, they were going to take that first place spot. But fucking Embiid, dude. I don't know where this guy's coming from. But every time he's on the court, I swear to God, he is doing shit, man.
I have a hot take on last night's game because I was watching the coverage all morning long, like Get Up, First Take, The Jump. Everyone's hyping up the matchup. Finally, I mean, Harden isn't playing, but we were going to get to see KD and Kyrie going up against the Sixers for the number one seed. I was all hyped for the game. And in my opinion, the Nets bitched out because what I think the Nets did not want to see, I get it, it was a back-to-back. They didn't want to play. KD's coming off the injury still. Rest him. But I think it was also an easy decision for them to make because they have nothing to lose. If they win the game without KD, then boom, it shoves it right in the Sixers' face and they're going to panic. If you lose that game, you are expected to lose, so nobody cares. You're not going to have any pressure on you as a team that the Sixers might have a serious chance. I was just upset about it because I'm like, I thought we were going to actually be battle-tested in that game with KD and Kyrie, and I feel like the Nets just took the easy way out.
I'm not concerned about this whole sit the guys out on the back-to-backs thing. I've never really cared. It's annoying, you know, wanting to watch a game with a star, and if somebody pays for the ticket, I get that. The season shouldn't be – I don't think people should be worried about it this year, though, because only 2,000 people are in any given stadium at any given time. But if you are now – the number two seed, you're going into a game with the other team that's vying for that number one spot. I understand that you want to potentially take over that number one spot, but at the same time, if your guys need the rest and it's going to help them to recharge for the playoffs, which is important, especially in Brooklyn this year, because it really is win or die for them because of what they've done this season to assemble this team. So if that's the case and these guys need rest, I know like Kyrie's converted to Islam and it's Ramadan, so he's fasting, so that's an issue that he's running into on his side. And you know, whatever happens with KD, you need to make sure that someone who's coming off an Achilles tear doesn't do anything to hurt, especially their lower extremities, because of what happened before, you know. So I get it. I know less than they do about the players' personal lives and the players' injuries and what's hurting. So I can't sit here and comment on what's happening with them.
Yeah, to touch upon the fact, I just think that, again, like Steve Nash went out and said that they bench Harden and KD just for maintenance, that it wasn't for the fact of like avoiding showing the Sixers cards. But I think there is a little bit into that. I think that they weighed their options. They saw that they could have rested both their stars again in a regular season that they know they're going to be a top two seed. And they're like, you know what? We don't want to show the Sixers all the looks we have for them just yet. We want to wait till we see them potentially in the playoffs because they are our biggest threat. They just made a prudent decision, a prudent business decision to rest their stars, give them the maintenance they need, because let me tell you, KD, Harden and Kyrie are all going to be playing 35 plus minutes every single night in the playoffs. And as of right now, regardless if you're the one or two seed in the East, you might have some difficult challenges in the first round. I mean, right now you're looking at either the Celtics or Miami potentially being the 7 and 8 seeds. I mean, I know the Hornets are at the 8 seed right now, but those two teams aren't far off from falling back to the 8 seed, and the Heat are the 7 seed. I mean, that's a very slap in the face first round playoff matchup. And then you could potentially see the Bucks in the second round too. I mean, the playoffs aren't potentially finalized yet. And I just think that the Nets made a good business decision. They didn't play everyone yet. And I just think that they need to give that core 15 to 20 games in the regular season to kind of play all at the same time together, be able to get used to each other on the court. And then after that, they'll be able to figure it out. I mean, these are three of the more talented offensive players and three of the more talented NBA players in the whole NBA association. Give them a little bit. They'll figure it out. I have no worries about the Nets. I have no worries about the Sixers. I mean, I liked what I saw. Didn't like how they closed out that game, but I like that they're still going out, trying to get the one seed. I'd like to see Embiid get a little bit more rest down the stretch, along with Simmons and along with Harris, because they've been the rocks all season long, both Harris and Simmons. But other than that, I mean, if you're a Nets and Sixers fan, there's nothing to be more happy about than what you're seeing out of both these teams as of right now.
How fucking funny is it that like Blake Griffin's yamming again in games? Like he refused to dunk when he was on the Pistons, and now he's just throwing it down like nothing.
Dude, it was a total scam.
What the fuck was that, dude? What's happening?
Not to go down this road, but it's almost like the exact same scam that people are trying to cook up on this whole Deshaun Watson thing about. Did you guys see that whole thing with the Texans owner's neighbor is like the defendant's lawyer.
The neighbor's his lawyer. Yeah. I mean, there's too many. Just like to touch on that really quick. There's too many accusations for it to not have some to it.
No doubt.
But like personally, I would love for it to not be true because apparently I look like Deshaun Watson like a lot. And I don't need to be mistaken for someone who does shit like that at massage parlors. So that we'll see what happens with him. But yeah, no, it's funny, though, because I always thought this about Blake. Like I always thought he was like a quiet guy who didn't really get emotional about things. But it's clear that like he's pissed at the Clippers, not the Pistons. He's more mad at probably at the Clippers for fucking stuffing him away in Detroit. And he knew how disorganized that entire organization was. And so he doesn't, there's no love lost clearly between him and the Pistons, and there's definitely probably no love lost between him and the Clips because they kind of did him dirty, honestly. I don't, you know, he gets some surgeries, he loses some value, and then they just fucking ship him out. So, I mean, you know, good for him. I'm a Knicks fan, so I'm not really too happy that he's on the Nets, but, you know, whatever makes him play well, I guess, fuck him. So, by the way, the Knicks are, what, the sixth seed? They just won their fourth straight last night.
They are.
I was waiting for both of you guys actually to be on an episode so I can ask you this question. So they beat the Pelicans, and when I was watching, I wasn't able to watch the whole game, but when I was watching bits and pieces of it, the Pelicans are so undisciplined on both offense and defense. And I think to myself, like, is Stan Van Gundy like a bad coach?
Yeah, I just think he's an outdated coach at this point. Like, I just think that what he had in Orlando worked at the time because it was groundbreaking. I mean, to surround a player with four shooters and four guys at that point in time, like to have like a five out, like a four out offense was groundbreaking. But now in the NBA, that's the norm. And usually teams even go five out offenses nowadays. And the fact of the matter is that Stan Van Gundy just isn't a good coach. Like, I don't know what it's going to take for people to accept that. But, I mean, he has the talent on his Pelicans team to be good. And they just aren't. I mean, they have Steven Adams. They have Brandon Ingram. They have Zion Williamson. They have Lonzo Ball. I mean, they have good players. They have Bledsoe.
They have a Lonzo Ball, by the way, that's playing, like, the best basketball of his life.
Yeah. Exactly. And, like, and the thing is people are always going to hamper on Lonzo Ball because he plays a very unsexy brand of basketball and passing the ball a lot and being a distributor at first, which we'll touch into a little bit later. But it's just the fact is that the Pelicans are a very underachieving team for the second year in a row. And I just believe that Stan Van Gundy isn't the guy there. I think you need a guy that's going to galvanize the troops a little bit more because I just feel like the Pelicans aren't a, you know, motivated team. I think they're great offensively. I think they're very talented, but their talent doesn't show up on the defensive side of the basketball, and they don't have any motivation, any effort whatsoever to play any goddamn defense. And we see this time in and time out. The Vegas book sees it by putting their over-unders at 235 to 240 for every given basketball game. Everyone and their mom knows the Pelicans can't play a lick of defense to save their life. And that goes strictly to coaching. Yeah, I get the NBA. It doesn't play defense anymore. But you got to play a semblance of defense if you want to win basketball games. And they just don't at all. They never show up. The times they win basketball games is because they put up 135 to 140 points. And you're never going to win games like that. Like, they're the better version of the Timberwolves. And that's just how it is.
Yeah, I completely agree. And when you name all those guys, they're all great players in their own right. But I think the issue with this team is a lot of the structure and the way it was built, because you have so much talent there, but I don't think they all work together. It's a lot going on with one ball to go around. And Lonzo Ball is an interesting player, but I don't think he fits quite right with what they have going on the team right now. And I think a lot of it goes back to that trade, the Anthony Davis trade. It was almost like they were trying to compile as many assets as possible, which worked out to their advantage, but it was kind of just like a grab whatever we can type deal. And then you added Zion, which complicates matters even further. I just think, like, you have a lot of guys on this team playing the best brand of basketball that they have in their entire career, and look at their record. It's just not working out together with a bunch of guys who are having career years, which I've never really seen before.
I think it's, you know, the thing about Lonzo that while he plays, I mean, the way he's playing right now, I cannot say anything bad about the guy because he's playing really good basketball. He's shooting the ball very well. He's shooting a lot more, and he's got his confidence back, which I think was lost because of, honestly, who knows? Maybe criticism. Maybe he just wasn't there yet. Maybe it was a learning curve. Who knows? He's only 24 or something. Like, he's got time left. So we'll see what his arc looks like for his career. He's not a drive and dish kind of player, though. And I think that that's really needed for a team like the Pelicans, because if you think about, let's do this scenario, and I've seen this in practice, and it seems like it works pretty well. You put the ball in Eric Bledsoe's hands, you know, let him get to the basket. While he's driving, you have Zion coming around or behind, you know, the defenders. And when Zion gets the ball, he's got, if Bledsoe doesn't have the shot, he kicks it out to Zion. Zion has all of the momentum, and he scores 40 points a game doing that shit. Because who's going to stop him? You know, Zion figured out what works for him, and what works for Zion is to get to the basket and have a soft touch there because he's just fucking stronger than everybody. And it's working. So to have him and another, I would say you can probably put Brandon Ingram in the category of an elite scorer at this point. Anybody who can put up 24 a game for multiple years, I think, can be considered an elite scorer, regardless of what the point share is.
Especially with the way he scores too. I mean, he can take
multiple ways.
Yeah, I mean, he has so much in his bag. I mean, he's the Swiss Army knife in offense. I mean, he can drive you to the net. He can shoot over you. I mean,
he's a poor man's KD.
And people say that all the time. Like, but that's not a bad thing. Like, poor man's KD.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Is one of the best scoring players, and is a top 10 scorer in the league, which
big
he
time.
Is.
Exactly, and so having those two assets with Zion as a generational talent, I think. As a 20-year-old, 21-year-old guy already doing what he does, you cannot waste that. You can't even waste a year of it because he is too strong. And he, unfortunately, I've been saying it since he got drafted, there's going to be issues with Zion Williamson. It's the way he plays is just too physical, you know. So you got to get out of him what you can, and you got to take advantage of every single game. So they're not doing it. It's a front office issue. It's unfortunate because we were talking about this before the season. They have they're 1-5 right now is like pretty fucking good. Yeah. If you think about it. If you factor in everybody healthy, right? You could potentially say it would go Lonzo, Eric Bledsoe, Ingram, Zion, and then Steven Adams at 5. Like that that's a team that can win games, you know?
Like, how is
and
that
you
not
have
a
Jackson
playoff
Hayes
team?
On the bench, Kira Lewis on the bench, like guys who can do stuff, JJ on the bench, like guys who can come off the bench and produce. There's no reason why this team should lose this many times. There's no reason for it. You know,
no.
I think we're all in agreement. It's got to be Stan Van Gundy. And I liked your point there too, Mike. It is an antiquated version of basketball that he's accustomed to. Even though he had shooters on that Orlando Magic team, he was developing an entire game plan around a 6'10" center who couldn't shoot from outside of 10 feet, which is not something that you can do anymore. You know,
yeah.
He was the last bastion there. It was Shaq, Dwight, and then it's gone. So there is no way to do that anymore. And so now he's trying to develop something else, a different way. The only time he found success is by playing his offense that way, and it's just not working. So what do you do? I don't know if he has another style that works for him. I think obviously at this point it's just not gonna. It was a good experiment though. You got to give if Stan Van's available, I think it's only fair that you should at least give him a shot. But I think that this is a good example of, I don't know if he's still the same coach that he used to be.
I think he's better. I think a Stan Van Gundy would be a better suited guy to take a year to go down to the D'Antoni route and become an assistant coach for an extremely good basketball team. Be able to learn how to win again. Be able to be in a winning environment. Being able to jive with those players. Because, I mean, while Steve Nash does have the official title head coach, Mike D'Antoni is that head coach for the Nets, and his offense development of such guys as like Elise Johnson, Nicholas Claxton, that is all monumental success of the Brooklyn Nets this year. And I think Stan Van Gundy would be great in trying to take something off of that, becoming an assistant coach for a year or two. If he proves he still wants to be in the show, he proves that he still wants to be a head coach, then put him as a head coach somewhere else where he can have where he can develop players and where he can be a guy that can be good. Because I think the biggest issue with here isn't the way this team's structured. I just think it's player development. And I think that goes along with just the Pelicans training. I think that goes along with just the coaching as well. And just developing these players to be two-way players or to conjunct as a basketball team. Because they've developed these guys and to be individually good talents, but they haven't developed these guys into having great chemistry with one another. And I think that's where the fundamental failure of the Pelicans lies, is the fact, like Mark said, they have a lot of good players and a lot on paper, a good team. But when you get on the court, it doesn't work out for either it's unluckiness, the lack of defense, turnovers, which is a lot of undisciplined reasons. And that goes back to the fact of coaching and player development. And I just think that that's what needs to be the focal point of the Pelicans in the offseason. Maybe try to get, like, I don't, like, their cap is, like, they have a lot of nice, like, paying a lot of money to contracts. But maybe you could swing a move for a good player in the offseason, see what can happen. Like, Oladipo would be a great fit for this team if he becomes available, because I know, like, his, like, deal's about to expire. If he becomes available, he could be a great fit for this team. But overall, I believe there are just one or two pieces away from, like, getting over that hump of being a potential playoff team to a perennial playoff team. But I think it all starts with being a good playoff team, with getting your house in order and getting a good infrastructure in place.
They could use a couple bench pieces, but I'm not so sure they even need to make additions. More so, it's who is this coach going to be that they bring in? Because I don't even know who's going to be on the market. We have to wait and see who gets fired. But there's not a lot out there right now as far as coaching goes. And you're going to have to look somewhere, an assistant on a very good team. Right now, I don't know exactly who those options are going to be, but they're going to be limited when it comes to this coaching search if they do move on from Van Gundy. Yeah, that's not a bad call. I mean, the perfect fit.
Jason Kidd's available. I mean, you can look at the former players. I don't know. I think when you look at cohesiveness of a unit, I think that having a former player could potentially even help. Because Stan Van, while a great coach, I don't know if he has the ability to tie a locker room together, at least now.
Dude, this transitions from our last episode kind of nicely. Right. The perfect fit would be Chris Paul, but once he retires. But we also were questioning whether or not his
years left.
Yeah, his attitude.
I also don't think that Stan Van's going to get fired yet. I don't know. I doubt that they brought him in for a 1 year flyer and then, like, are going to fire him if he's not successful right away, even though the team's good. I don't see that happening, but
it's not a good sign to move on that quick after Gentry.
Right.
And all that.
And I think it will reflect really poorly on the locker room to bring in a new coach and, 1 year afterwards. So
I don't think he's a goner just yet, but if he, like, don't be surprised next year if they're struggling like this hard during the middle of the regular season, he could be seeing his way out.
If Scott Brooks still has a job, I think Stan Van should have a job.
So, like,
I can't believe he's still there, man.
Yeah. So, like, I was looking at, but you know who would be a great replacement for Scott Brooks? Juwan Howard from Michigan. He played a lot of Wizards ball. He won
college to the NBA. Transition is that the college gives you, like, the keys to the castle, like, you are the alpha and the omega of that program. That's like with Jim Boeheim, right? He coached Syracuse for 40 years. The amount of NBA offers he's gotten is astronomical at this point. Every NBA team has at some point, not every, but, a lot of NBA teams at some point have come to him and offered an interview and a job for him to coach their teams. And he just says, no, I don't want to do that. And it's because the college basketball style is very different. I think Juwan Howard is a good coach, and I think that he has the capability of leading this. The Michigan team is going to be good for a minute, especially with him, because I think he's going to be a good recruiter as well. I don't know if he's going to be interested in going to the NBA just yet.
Yeah, it's way too soon, because he just got there. Like, that was literally – people were questioning whether – a lot of people thought Michigan would be trash this year because it's his first year coaching, a little bit of an adjustment. But
I think it's his second
year
or third
year. Yeah, it's his second year.
Besides first tournament. But yeah, I think that's something down the road that could definitely be an option for him. I mean, he was pretty much an assistant coach on all of those Miami Heat teams.
Yeah, I just think he's going to be a hell. Yeah, exactly. That's my point. I just think he'd be a great coach because he knows what it's like to play in the NBA. He knows he can talk from anywhere from a backup point guard to a team owner, and he'd be used to talking to both ways. And he's kind of brought from like reports I've read, from like articles I've read, he's brought a very NBA feeling to Michigan. He'd be perfect within the next couple of years. Because even like maybe even as soon as next year, but I think he'd be a really good fit as a head coach because like you're talking about with Boeheim, like, yeah, he was a guy that like wanted to stay in college for his whole life, but that's because he built his legacy all throughout college. Like Juwan Howard was an NBA player. He was an established personality before he got to the University of Michigan. So I think he'll be a very good coach in the NBA based off that. I know what you're saying, like play, like coaches build their legacies throughout college. Like, for example, we'll never see like Coach K, Roy Williams, guys like John Calipari who tried an NBA, didn't really work out that well. But guys like that won't either stay in college, succeed in college, stay in the NBA, succeed in the NBA, or even make that jump because they're so comfortable with what they're doing in the college ranks. So I think Juwan Howard's more along the lines he's going to make that jump. It's just a question of when and when he gets that offer.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like Michigan's going to throw a bunch of money at him to keep him there. Because it's tough to find a good coach, honestly. It's tough to find a good coach. If you're at a blue chip program, it can be difficult if you have bad coaching to get rid of a coach. If they're good, it's tough because the next guy could come in and he's not a good recruiter or whatever the case is. It's only a four year at most turnaround time, you know, for these players. So, but we'll see. I actually agree with you. I think that makes a lot more sense than I thought initially, just because, yeah, he's versed in it. And he of course is pretty well renowned in the Baltimore or the DMV area. So that's that'll actually make sense to me. Now we all three of us actually wanted to talk about this. We follow this guy Rashad Phillips. I followed him first, I'm just gonna say that, but whatever. He is this analytics guy who has predicted like a bunch of players and their come-ups at this point. Like he was talking about Ja's freshman year at Murray State. Like nobody knew who Ja Morant was, and now he does. Everybody knows him. He was saying what Trae Young was going to be and how he was probably, besides Luka, the most prized possession in the draft of that year, and everybody was calling him crazy because of Trae, and now look at what he is, you know. So, like, this guy knows what he's talking about, and he developed this system of positions. He developed this new positional rankings or position manual or whatever you want to call it to describe players in a more accurate way than it used to be described. Because as it stands right now, it goes point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center, as it used to be. But with the development of the game of basketball and with the evolution of the style of play, those positions, they just don't make sense anymore. And I think he's absolutely correct in saying that. And so we wanted to go through today and next week. We're going to go through because there's a lot more now. I think there's 12 total, so we're not going to be able to touch on all of them today. We're going to go through the guards, and we're going to talk about his positions and some examples of these positions as it stands for the NBA today, and also what other examples of these people might have been in the past. So the first one that we were going to talk about, it's actually a dying position, I would say. I don't know if you guys would agree, but it's like kind of not, it's not really in existence all that much anymore. And that is your traditional guard. And what he means by a traditional guard is what we used to consider a quote unquote point guard, right? Somebody who you would think to be a point guard. They pass first. That's all they think about. They're not considering scoring for themselves. They're more interested in setting up their teammates for passes or for assists and to run an offense that way. I think the best example historically, at least in my lifetime, I'm sure there's been more earlier on, it would be somebody like a Rajon Rondo in his prime on the Celtics, when he would literally have an open shot and he would pass it up because he didn't want to take the shot. He wanted to get the assist. Right now, as I mentioned before, it's kind of dying. It's not really something that we see all that often as a point guard or as a traditional guard. today I would say the best examples are the ones that he gave, honestly, and I can't think of honestly literally any other ones, at least right now, of these examples. And those two that he actually gave as examples were Ricky Rubio and Lonzo Ball. And you could still say Rajon because he's still playing, I think, technically still playing. So do you guys know, can you guys think of any other, like, any other examples of a traditional guard, somebody who plays that way?
I would argue that, like, it's starting point guard wise at this point, they're very obsolete. I mean, back in the day, there were like a lot of the greatest point guards of all time were like this. Stockton, obviously, Gary Payton, I would say, fit along those lines. Nowadays, I feel like you see these guys leading bench units more often than not. And I would have to look at every bench really in the NBA, but a guy like a TJ McConnell is your traditional guard type player. And I still think we do see them leading bench units. A lot of them are like probably in the last decade, some have retired, but there were guys like Jarrett Jack, Steve Blake, like those types of players leading bench units, even Jeff Teague. Those are the types of guys that I would say were more traditional guards, but you're right. They just don't really exist anymore because these guards are so versatile. I mean, even somebody like a Chris Paul at a point in his career was a little bit more traditional, and now he's your true point guard, as we're going to get into, where he learned how to create his own shot and do a little bit of everything. It's very rare. I definitely think that Rondo is probably the best example we've had in the past 20 years.
And there's been guys in the past. Scott Skiles is a good example of it on the early Magic teams with Shaq and Penny. You know, his entire offense was just dishing. That's all he had.
Andre Miller, too, as a guy.
That's another one I would have said. Eric Snow is another one. Just a bunch of guys who they didn't really set. They were sacrificing their offense for the good of the team.
Another guy that, like, as a traditional guard in the NBA now that is still a part of that is that one guy we didn't bring up. It was Elfrid Payton. I would argue, is a guy like that, because he's a guy that, how many times have you seen Elfrid Payton have like 8 points and like 11 assists for zero reason? But like, he's a guy that really like fancies more rebounding and assisting as a guy rather than like making his own shot and creating his own offense.
And it cuts right back into Mark's point about like how they're not always the biggest names, especially not now, because they're not exactly exciting to watch. No, you're not going to like watch Elfrid Payton, and you're not going to buy a ticket to go watch Elfrid fucking Payton play basketball. You know
who's another great example of what I was saying with leading bench units? How about Sean Livingston for those Golden State teams?
He was definitely
a traditional guard leading a bench unit.
Yeah. So the second one that people would consider to be a point guard, and what Rashad would consider to be a point guard, is a little, I would say, different than what people consider to be a point guard today. And that is, you know, it's somebody who has a blend of it, right? They are, I would say, you can even consider them to be more pass first, but they're still going to be able to use their offense to take over a game, score a bunch of points at any given time, and, you know, be able to be the catalyst of the offense as well as distributing it, making their teammates better, elevating the team. And there's, throughout history, been a ton of these examples. Magic Johnson, I would say John Stockton would fall more into a point guard because he had the capabilities of scoring whenever he wanted to, a lot of times when he wanted to, and he could take over games at certain points. He just didn't really a lot of times. So he's kind of on the cusp there. The best examples today, I'm just going to focus on the one. The best example of this today is Chris Paul, and it's been Chris Paul for more than a decade at this point. The ability that he has to elevate the team without scoring is something that we haven't really seen in my lifetime. I haven't seen before, and I think it's important for us as NBA fans to understand the value and the impact that Chris Paul has had on the Suns team. Going back to what you were talking about, Mike, and I'm glad that we waited to talk about the Suns for a little bit. This team is very similar to what that team was last year. That team last year was kind of bounced and barely didn't make the playoffs, had to win every single game in the bubble to have a shot to make the playoffs and still missed it. And now they're the number two seed in the West. And if it wasn't for this just going the fuck off Jazz team, they'd be the best team in the entire league. So that's the impact he has.
No, 100%. And this Suns team, I mean, other than him and Jay Crowder, is their only major additions. I mean, this team's night and day from what they've been for years in the past. That's the Chris Paul effect. I mean, everywhere he goes, he elevates the team to a winning team, to a team that's a playoff contender. And now, all of a sudden, the Suns are only a game and a half out of the one seed in the West, which is unbelievable. And they're a team that's a very dangerous team. I mean, but they play a great brand of offense. They play a great brand of defense. They give you 48 minutes a night of hard-earned basketball. And that's crazy, because if you would have told me that 2 years ago, I would have been like, you're psychotic. Because this Suns team before, everyone used to think they were soft. Everyone used to think they couldn't play a lick of defense. DeAndre Ayton was soft. Devin Booker was soft. Like, all these guys on their team that just weren't enough snuff and didn't have the balls to go out and play consistently good basketball. But look at this team now, a team that's 39-15 and that's 9-1 in their last 10 games. The Suns are not a team to mess with. And this goes back to the point, Chris Paul as the point guard has defined the definition of point guard in the NBA for the last 10 years. And he's going to be doing that for the next 50 years and beyond in the NBA for sure.
You know, Chris Paul has just been the epitome of that position for years and years now, and he's constantly changed with the NBA, which it's ironic we talk about it the way we are, because, you know, Chris Paul's career kind of illustrates he has been through the changes of NBA basketball more than anyone really in the league. And he is exactly why this position chart really has been made by Rashad Phillips in a way. And I think more than every position has their reasons for why they need to be described in and broken down into more categories. But point guard might illustrate that the most. And Chris Paul throughout his career has been able to just change his game and evolve on a game-by-game basis. He is the epitome of that true point guard right now, which used to not be this way. I mean, we see him some games with the Suns literally score less than 10 points and assist the ball 12 times and catch 5 rebounds and lead the team to, in a game that they would have lost last season, to end up winning by 15 instead. And at the same time, then he has games where he shoots absurdly well from the field and he is scoring, leading the team in scoring with 24 to 28 points a game. So he can kind of swing and do whatever they really ask him. And the other thing that's great about him is those games where he sits back and he's not really scoring a lot, go look at the amount of shots he's taken. It's not that he's missing shots. It's that he literally is dishing the ball so often and facilitating that offense that he quite literally will shoot the ball 6 times in a game and not even need to put up those shots, and they're still winning.
I mean, he's a little guy who uses his size when he can, or he knows how to overcome the size thing. And we talked about this last time we talked about him. He knows how to overcome it and to be able to get his shots off, which is insane the way he's able to get some of these shots off that he does. At the same time, that pure point guard vision is very uncommon in people to have. It is difficult to have that as a point guard, being able to see somebody before they know that they're open, right? To recognize a play developing from anywhere on the court, having that kind of ability. That's what he has, probably better than almost everybody who's ever played the game, maybe with the exception of Magic and John Stockton and, you know, some of those big name guys that came out before him. Isaiah, I think, is a good example of somebody who had that as well. And another example of probably a traditional point guard also at that front. I would also say other examples of a point guard, somebody who's able to mix it, blend it well. I would honestly put Ja Morant in this. because of his ability to mix it up. You know, he has games also where he's only scoring 12, 13 points, and the Grizzlies can still win those games because he's able to be a presence on the offense in a lot of other ways. And I think that has a lot to do with his ability as a point guard. So I would put him into that. The other big one that Rashad talks about is Trey. Trey's one that is an up and coming, you know, pure point guard from what he's able to do offensively, getting his assists, getting his shots up, being able to do both of those things. I think that's another good example of it.
I'm gonna close with the biggest name that we have not mentioned once, and I'm pretty positive he would fit in this. First off, though, I think Kyle Lowry would fit in this. I think, would you guys agree with that? Kyle Lowry would fit here.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes.
The other one, I'll just skip right to the big name that I was going to say, and I'm curious to hear what you guys think about this, but LaMelo Ball has got a fit in this because he can score clearly more than his brother can, which is why I think the difference between LaMelo and Lonzo is the definition of the difference between traditional guard and point guard. LaMelo has that gift where he can see things that no other player on the floor can see, but he's not, which is what a traditional guard does, but he can go get you those buckets whenever you need, just like a Trae Young. And that separates him from his brother, from the guys that we talked about in the last segment, such as Rajon Rondo and all of those guys. I definitely think though LaMelo is what we see with that point guard and is what made him so special coming out of that draft.
I haven't seen enough of him. Who knows? You know, he might fall into this one. He might also fall into the next one.
I agree with more of Nick. Like, I think you make excellent points there, Mark, but I just think LaMelo, it's too soon to tell with him. I mean, this was a developmental year for him. I mean, there's like of all the things that we've talked about in terms of the guard and how we're going to classify each guard. I mean, he could totally fall under the combo guard. He could fall under the hyper guard. There's a lot of different labels he could fall under, just depending on what he chooses to do. If he chooses to become a guy that wants to put up like 20 and 10 a night, then yeah, he'll be a point guard. But if he chooses that, I want to go out and score like 25 and put up 6 like assist a game, then that's more of the combo guard that we've seen before in guys like a Donovan Mitchell, for example, or even to a lesser extent like a Tyler Hero or Colin Sexton, guys that choose that want to score, would rather score like 20 to 25 points and put up 5 to 6 assists rather than guys that would put up like 10 assists and score 18 to 20 points a game. So it really depends on how the Hornets plan on using him, and it also depends on how LaMelo decides to amplify and develop his game. Does he want to focus on passing the ball and initiating and distributing, or does he want to focus on being the it guy, being the guy that he's going to catch a ball at the top of the key, he's either going to step back and shoot, drive to net, come up, like get movement going and try to get someone, other people involved. It all depends on what he really feels comfortable in doing.
My question there, though, would be, if that's – I totally get what you guys are saying with we need to see more from LaMelo to really put him in a box like that. But my counter would be for Trae Young, that's somebody that I get it, whether he's putting up 35 or not, he's still – his assists are there. But Trae Young is somebody that could swing into a hybrid in that situation too, because we all know his usage rate is through the roof. He's not somebody that ever takes that seat back and puts up a 12-point game.
I think you should – the way I look at it is sort of like a pendulum on the guard front, right? For the point guard, the pendulum on this side is traditional, and then it kind of swings to the middle, and that's the point guard, and then it goes to the right-hand side, and this is where you fall into the hybrid, you know? And the hybrids are guys when you think about these guys, you don't think – you know that they're playmaking as well, but you also know that they're – that's their focus isn't on the playmaking, it is on the scoring, and they're so good at it that they're able to dominate games that way, and that's why they're so dangerous. So, you know, the hybrid guard, the way that Rashad talks about it, he says it's a rare breed of scorer and initiator. He says, this type of player can disrupt your entire game plan. And I think he's exactly correct on that. I think just let's talk about Steph last night. Fucking 11 threes in three quarters. And he did that like the game before. He dropped 50. You know, he does whatever the fuck he wants. And he's a point guard. And he can get 7 to 8 assists in any given night. That's not what he's on the court to do, though. He's a high, and so calling him a point guard, I think, is he has a great point. I don't believe that Steph Curry can be classified as a point guard, but he's obviously not a shooting guard. It's the issue that we ran into when he was getting drafted. It's why he fell to 7 instead of being a top 3 pick in that draft, is because people didn't know what they were, where they were going to put it, especially now talking about these updated positions, right? Hybrid guard, the examples are Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, probably a top 3 MVP candidate right now. Damian is. You have cases like, on the, you know, go down the scale here. Kyrie, easily, is one of those guys. Colin Sexton is an example of this. You can also make a case for Jamal. You know, what's Jamal's role in the offense? He's there. He's kind of fringy. I would say he's probably fallen into the next category that we'd be talking about here. But those are, I would say, the biggest names. What other names would you guys put on this?
Would you guys say De'Aaron Fox falls on under this umbrella?
I would.
Yes. I would. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I would say that in the beginning of his career, he would have been considered more of a combo guard, but I think he has shifted now to the play initiator and a scorer, so I think he actually would fit well in that.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that sentiment as well. I would say, even to a lesser extent, like, what do you guys think of Darius Garland, the running mate of Colin Sexton?
I think Garland might actually be more of a combo than he would be a hybrid, so we'll talk about him maybe in the next one. But Sexton, I think, is a great example. Kyrie's a great example.
Dame and Steph are great examples.
Dame and Steph. Prime D-Rose could fall potentially into this. I think he probably might be more of a point guard, honestly. He was a good distributor.
Russ.
Russ, for sure. Well, see, that's the issue with Russ, though, because, like, he does – his usage is off the charts, so we have to look at where – I don't know. It's what the blend looks like, right? When is he more capable of dominating your team? If Russ isn't scoring 20, 30 points a game, can his team still be successful? Obviously, they're not successful at all anyway, but, like, you know, that's the kind of the thing. So I honestly potentially would put Russ in the point guard category, but I think that there is a very good case for his hybrid guard. Honestly, now that I think about it, I think he might fall into that a little bit more. I feel like his assists are just to get triple-doubles.
What about, in the same breath now, a John Wall? How would we classify John Wall here?
I honestly would consider him a traditional guard or a point. No, because I think, you know, when I think traditional guard, I think of a guy who's not going to score their offensive production is contingent on their passing. And I don't think that's the case for John Wall. Right now, I think he would be considered a point guard.
Yeah, I would say John Wall is more of a point guard than anything else. I just think that he's that traditional guy that's going to focus on passing. He scores in fast break, as we all know how dangerous he can be with the ball in his hands. I would say he's more of a true point guard as well. Also, another person that's like a true point guard that can have a debate is Jonte Murray, too, who is a guy that, like, is a more focused passer, but he could score in spurts as well. He's a guy that gives up like 15 and 8 every single night on any given night. So
I like that a lot, and honestly, in a similar way, Fred VanVleet is a guy that he's almost just like we were talking about Kyle Lowry in that regard. VanVleet is somebody that could fit into there.
Yeah, I would say VanVleet's more of a like combo guy, though. Wouldn't you guys say that? Because I mean,
I would say he's a combo. Honestly, but here's the thing on this, Mike. When they transfer, because Lowry's going to probably be out after this year. Yeah. When that happens and the keys of the castle are given to Fred VanVleet, he is going to be the play initiator. And at that point, he will fall easily into the hybrid guard category because he is able to drop 30 on you every given day. And his passing, while renowned, it's not going to be the focal point of his offense. So I think he falls into that. Let's actually go into the combo guard section, because I think it's such an interesting it's these between hybrid and combo, there is a specific drop off. There is a difference, but there is, you know, I don't know, it, even within this, there's a fluidity to it, which I think is pretty cool. And the combo guards, like, this is obviously what you would say somebody who can change a game both on and off the ball, right? Like, they don't need the ball in their hands. They can start a play, but they're not always going to start a play, and they're going to be involved in the offense, whether it is as a play initiator or if it's somebody off of the ball. I think the best example right now of that is CJ McCollum. You could easily make a case for him being, you know, the number one guy when it comes to that. And then you have other examples. Let's see. Oladipo is another great example of this. You know, Victor Oladipo can easily change a game off the ball. We actually didn't talk about James Harden as a hybrid, so I just want to mention his name there so we can go back to mention that. But, yeah, I mean, those are some examples there. I got a question for you guys, a historical kind of question. Where would you put Allen Iverson?
I think he that's tough,
right?
I would swing towards hybrid because there's like Kyrie there. He has those Kyrie type of playmaking skills as well as being able to facilitate when he needs to. I definitely don't think he could I don't think he would climb any higher on this chart. I think he'd be more likely to drop to combo.
Well, yeah,
anything.
I mean, he's either a hybrid or a combo guard.
Yeah.
Just one of those two. I think
it's an interesting one.
Yeah, I feel like he would be a hybrid guard just because he did have the capability of, you know, setting up plays, being able to do those things to a higher extent than I think somebody who would be considered a combo guard would. So I think that I would put him there, but he's definitely on the cusp.
Now, this is a name that is highly forgotten just in basketball in general, but do you guys consider SGA a combo guard here?
Yeah. I think last year was the best example of that for me because of how successful and how productive he was with the ball out of his hands without initiating plays. I think that was kind of the deal maker for me on that one. So I would put him as a combo.
I completely agree. I think seeing him play with Chris Paul, and that's exactly what we're talking about here with, there are so many guys that throughout their career, I mean, look at what we just talked about with Van Vliet, with Kyle Lowry, with Chris Paul, and now with SGA, that can fit into 2, 3, 4 of these categories throughout their career, depending on who they're playing with. And that shows the real evolution of basketball and the evolution of a player's career. They're not just going to stay under the same category for their whole career. And if anything, I think that's what makes some of these players so great, is having that ability to take a different role and excel in that different role depending on who you're playing with. Something that, as we always talk about, Russell Westbrook is unwilling to do, and why he will never probably ever win a championship for that reason. It's something that you could argue down the road, even though I think for the most part he'll probably always be a hybrid guard. Dame Lillard, when he takes on a new team where he has more talent around him, maybe he becomes more of a point guard. It's possible. I think there's a lot of guys that throughout their career are going to take on different roles here.
Hearing all that from both of you guys, I agree. Personally, I just think that it's just amazing, honestly, from all these different types of evaluations we have with these guards, of how the NBA has kind of diversified itself, and how the fact of the matter is that there's so many different ways for teams to win basketball games. I mean, look at the Spurs. I mean, the Spurs have a plethora of guys who could fall under the umbrella of like pure positions of what they do. They have pure guys in roles of point guard, shooting guard, small forward. They're a very traditional basketball team. And then you have teams like the Brooklyn Nets, for example, who are winning a bunch of games with guys that have all these different types of things. Like, for example, Kyrie Irving's a hyper guard. James Harden can be like characterized either a hyper or combo guard. Kevin Durant will get to his
hybrid
classification. Huh?
It's hybrid.
Hyper. I am sorry. Not hyper. No, I'm hyper talking about this topic. So, you know what? It's hybrid. Hybrid guards are the new norm in the NBA, but it's just unbelievable to see that there's so much of a, like, a variety of different ways you can classify players who help you win basketball games now and what way you can go out and achieve that.
Who do you think the first example of a hybrid guard was? Maybe Jerry West.
Dude, that is exactly the name I was about to say.
I was thinking Jerry West. It's so cool to think about now, you know, because it's like he was a point guard, but he also played shooting guard a lot. You know, by a lot of people's recollections, he was considered a shooting guard, but he really wasn't. He was a point guard. You know, Pete Maravich is like that too. Tiny Archibald was probably more of a point guard, honestly, but... Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, it opens up an entirely new way of thinking, and I think that Rashad definitely has the right idea going with this. And, you know, obviously the NBA is too rigid to actually adopt this, but I think that as NBA fans and people who follow this league, I think that we would be remiss not to pay attention to it this way. The last one that we're going to go into today, because we're just doing the guards today, and this one is going to be something that, you know, the traditional shooting guard. It's not traditional shooting guard. It's a shooting guard, right? And a shooting guard is what we saw with, like, a Kobe Bryant, right? I think that's the best example. Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan. That's exactly what it, you know, what we looked at as a shooting guard. And that is exactly what it still is today. It's somebody who is going to create their offense off the ball predominantly. They're able to elevate a team with usually just their scoring because they are so good at it. And I think the best examples of this today are Klay, Book, Jaylen Brown. Let's see, who else can we make it? You can make a case for Brad Beal. He might, I mean, his size kind of puts him in a weird bucket potentially as a combo, but I would say he was more of a traditional shooting guard today. Who else would you guys think?
Do we go Donovan Mitchell here?
Yeah, actually, we forgot to talk about Mitch as a combo. I put him as a combo.
Combo as well. And
even hybrid, because he plays a lot of point guard, but I would say he's more of a combo.
He's a combo guy for sure.
In the same breath, Mike Conley, we skipped over his name, I guess. They're weird, dude. They're weird because they both do like very – they both could swing from – several different categories depending on who's facilitating the ball.
Conley is as close to being a traditional guard as somebody who would be a point guard could be.
Yeah.
I think that his impact on the offense is not contingent on his passing. There is an aspect of his scoring. I don't think he sacrifices his point production for playmaking. I think that he blends it very well, which is why people like to put him in the potential, like, quote, don't fucking yell at me because I don't put him there, but people have the quote unquote Hall of Fame possibility conversation, you know, because of the, I don't agree with it.
I know. I heard that.
But you know, people have said it, and I've heard it. I'm sure you've heard it.
Oh, yes.
NBA Twitter's retarded. So like he blends it very well. So I think that you have to put him in the point guard category for that reason.
I get the whole Kyle Lowry debate, which I still don't agree with, but I still understand it. But my God, if somehow, some way, Mike Conley snakes his way into the Hall of Fame, I will never, ever use a Hall of Fame as a debate on whether a player is good or not ever again, because that's absolutely absurd.
That'd be really bad.
I would
never watch another one. I couldn't watch another one.
Guy couldn't make an all-star team as a reserve, and now he's going to get in a fucking Hall of Fame. Get the hell out of here.
Well, he technically got an all-star nod this year. He was on the team. He just like was the last one, and I didn't agree that he should have been there. I think there was like 12 people who should have been in front of him. But
yeah, Trae Young should have been there. I know it's different conferences, but Trae Young should have been.
Yeah.
Is your hair
growing back okay?
Oh yeah, no. Now yeah,
I was
now,
a little disappointed. He only went 201, Mark. I was hoping that he was gonna go full buzz. He only went 201.
And we didn't get a video.
No, yeah. I can personally shave it, but I did send pictures of it though.
Yeah, so he did it. He's a man of his word. It's okay.
Absolutely. I respect it.
He did
it. Looking at this list, though, I don't know if you guys would agree on this, because there's very few. I mean, we're going to move into the big men next week, but I don't see many flaws with how this is mapped out. But I do kind of wish that the shooting guard position had another – I wish it was divided, because there are so many shooting guards that – like. It doesn't really make much sense to me to name Kobe Bryant and J.J. Redick in the same category. To name a Bradley Beal.
I think it does, though. I actually disagree on it, because the way that they score is similar. Obviously, completely different levels, you know, of course. But I think the way J.J.'s off the ball, Kobe is not initiating plays. He's getting the ball in the positions that he wants, and then he's creating the offense from there for himself a lot of times. So, like, that's what he did. JJ's doing the same thing, except he's just catch and shoot. You know,
but what about
Klay Thompson, like, scores 60 points, catch and shoot the entire time? I think somebody who you can also make a case for probably falls a little bit more into the combo than shooting guard, but I would say he's a shooting guard, and Zach LaVine, you know, where he is 6'5". Just the you know, the appropriate height for it, and I think that he is most effective when he is getting his shots set up for him.
No, I 100% agree with that. I feel like, and again, like, let me tell you something. Let me give a shout out to that real quick with Bradley Beal. Was the fact of the matter is that it goes back to the old thing. Like, Russell Westbrook does elevate his teammates better. I mean, look at, like, his track record. Of like guys that have had career years, I mean, Paul George, James Harden, and now Bradley Beal. I mean, I feel like Bradley Beal works off the ball particularly the best he can, and we've seen Bradley Beal have his most success, like, efficiently wise, and also just, like, counting numbers wise, when he works off the ball, when he's able to come off a screen, when he's able to, like, cut to the basket, when he's able to just kind of get into a wheelhouse and kind of get set up. Where he can, that's where he works the best, not being the guy that has the initiator that works. So he can do that. He can bring up the basketball. But he's best suited and more optimized when he's working off the ball. I 100% agree with that.
Another name, too, he has to be mentioned when we talk about shooting guards. Assuming you guys want to put him there, but I'm guessing you do, and that's Dwayne Wade.
Ooh.
He can swing tricky. The combo.
Right, that's tricky, because when he was a rookie, he played point guard almost exclusively.
Yeah.
So he's been able to do both.
He's
had years where he's averaged 5 or 6. Yeah. No, I wouldn't say hybrid. I wouldn't go that far. I would say he's a combo guard at best, because even with the LeBron years, they would have point guards. They had Chalmers and stuff, but, you know, D-Wade and LeBron, all three of those guys could initiate.
Norris, they had the good old Norris Cole back in the day.
Norris, high top fucking Cole. Norris, I'm 5'9", but my high top makes me 6 foot, Cole.
Dude, he was dirty. He was dirty in NBA 2K.
He was annoying as fuck in real life. Hated that guy. Like Ray Allen, you know, he's a shooting guard for sure, no doubt. And just to go back to your point really quick, Mark, the shooting guard position, it's off the ball, and it's like the size usually is what the difference is, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, you go from that to a small forward, and it's usually just the style of play combined with the size, and now we're looking at a small forward instead of a shooting guard, just like we always have, you know?
Do you guys think that these position definitions are solely offensive based? Because that I think is where my mind is getting a little clouded with, like, talking about the shooting guard, because then there's also so many guys out there that existed.
Yeah, but, I mean, the old positions were solely offensive based too.
Yeah, that's fair.
The way
enough.
We looked at it was completely on offense, because you can match up anybody to anybody. So we went through the guards today. Next week we're going to talk about some touch points, just like we did today, and then we're going to go through the forwards and the centers. He's got a bunch of these, and it's interesting, and I think it's important for people to start to look at it. This is the kind of stuff that's revolutionary in a good way, because I think bucketing people correctly is the best way to scout. and the best way to see new faces. So when we do like things like mock drafts going down the road, this is going to be a better way for us to look at it. And I think we should start to exclusively talk about it this way. I don't know if you guys agree with me, but that's how I've been trying to look at it, at least since we've been going over this.
I completely agree, and I think more than anything, it's important for, and this is why it was created by Rashad, is for draft purposes. Because the reality is, when these guys, I mean, it's all fun and good having the debates that we just had about the players in the NBA, but those guys have all found their niche, and a lot of those guys have went through multiple categories throughout their career. But when these guys are getting drafted, too often we see players put in a box. And, you know, it results in a lot of guys being overdrafted based on need, or players falling in the draft who turn into great NBA players because we put them in these boxes instead of looking at these positions and realizing the way the NBA has changed. And it's not as traditional as it once was. I mean, the reality is, the Golden State Warriors are the biggest reason for what we're looking at right now. The Golden State Warriors changed the game of basketball in this sense, in positionless basketball, where really you can fall under any category, and it's all about a team-oriented brand, where depending on who is on that team and the role that those players are willing to take, the Golden State Warriors had just about every single player on this list in some shape or form throughout their dynasty.
We'll double back on this next week. Do you guys have anything going on in the meantime? Anything to report?
No, I personally don't have anything in particular. I mean, I'm just excited that – I'm just honestly can't wait for the finish line of the NBA season and getting to the playoffs and then getting into the NBA draft. Like, I feel like it's just like I love the NBA as of right now, obviously, because this is the most competitive we've seen it in years. But it's just frustrating because I want to get to that pinnacle of content where we have the playoffs we're talking about. Then we go right into draft mode. Like, all those things are so much fun to watch, in my opinion. They're so much fun to talk about, and free agency as well. Like, I just can't wait to see, like, more towards the end of the year and the offseason awards that we've talked about multiple times on here as too. I mean, there's so much open in the NBA that's left up to debate that I just can't wait to finally get the answers we've been talking about. That way we can break those down into more detail for the wonderful and beautiful viewers out there listening to us right now.
I couldn't agree more, I agree. Mike.
I fucking hate NBA Twitter. I just wanted to say that. Mark, what were you going to say?
No, I mean, I can second that one. Just enough of these freaking debates. And you know what? This fits perfectly with several things we discussed today. And, you know, it's not necessarily related to basketball because it's all about an NFL player that just recently retired. But Twitter, all of you Twitter fucks out there, can we please stop having these Hall of Fame debates the second a player retires across the board? I did just send out a tweet, by the way, that said Julian Edelman equals Andre Iguodala. But I'm sick of this Julian Edelman talk. Let the player breathe and let's celebrate his accomplishments before the entire Twitter world decides to jump down his throat that he's not a Hall of Famer when no one was debating that he was. I'm just sick of that shit. Sorry for the rant, but let's just I feel like we talk about Hall of Fame. I feel like we talk about Hall of Fame too quickly. Let's celebrate a great career when we see it, because there are great careers that aren't Hall of Famers in every sport.
Retweet, no pun intended. All right, folks. That's all I got. That's all they got. I'm done talking. So if you're not ugly, stay beautiful. And see you guys next week.